Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE. The European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome to the New Books in Economics series. This is a channel of the New Books Network, and I am your host, Andrea Bernardi from Oxford Brookes University. We are here today with the author of a great new book, and the title is Transition Economies, Transformation, Development and Society in Eastern Europe and the Former Soviet Union. The author is Alexander Gevorkian, and is now reaching us from New York, where he is Associate Professor in Economics, and in particular is Harry George Chair in Economics at the Department of Economics and Finance of the Peter Tobin College of Business at St. John's University in the United States. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. Can you tell us something about your current affiliation, your previous and your background, your education, and how you arrived to write this book? So what is the background of the book?
Absolutely. The path is very long. I'll try to keep it very short. I'm, as you mentioned, associate professor now in economics. But before that, I also had a bit of a corporate career. I was 11 years in consulting and then 2 years in public economic policy here in New York. But in the meantime, I would still be teaching and doing some research. Now, as I worked on figuring out some 10, 11, 15 years ago on what might be an interesting topic to focus on in terms of my research and doctoral dissertation at the New School in New York City. One topic kept coming up. I was interested in macroeconomic development in general, but I needed some regional focus. And what I found was that there wasn't really much in terms of a general overview on the economies that the book is about, sort of the post-socialist economies of Europe and former Soviet Union. And so my first attempt at doing anything serious in that field was back in 2008-2009, when I worked, when I started working in that area. And gradually, sort of things just evolve, and with teaching and teaching economic development, the topic started to reappear more and more frequently in my discussions, in my presentations, and some research. And eventually, I came to a realization that I might have enough material to actually sit down and work on the book. So there's that. In other words, I have a mix of kind of hopefully practical corporate career supplemented with academic work, and now fully focused on research and scholarship. About the book, well, again, the origin was back then. And when I started teaching and developing more or less transition economies focused curricula, I started kind of going through lots of literature. And what I found was that much of the literature was focusing on specific issues. There's no lack of publications on specific topics, and especially in the 90s and in the early 2000s, there was so much attention to the economic reforms, the different ways to measure success or failures and things like that, specific country studies. The World Bank has a dedicated unit on Europe and Central Asia. So no one could really try to rival. And in a way, I'm not trying to do that. But what I noticed is that most of the studies are specialized case study. And this is where I thought I could try and attempt to offer somewhat a different perspective with this book. And in a way, I try to combine this story of transition, or what we refer to as transition, in this economic history perspective in a more systematic way, involving all of the countries affected. Bit of a longish answer, but being sort of closely related to the topic, that's how I feel right at the moment about the book.
Very good. So you mentioned the keyword, which is transition, and if I'm not wrong, the field of transition economics has been always, and in particular since the fall of the Berlin Wall, associated with, let's say, a transition towards one possible direction, which was market economies within a context of liberal democracies. For now, many years, since 1991, this has been the case. But now I wonder whether the Chinese model is somehow changing the field of transition economics, since perhaps we have an additional model which is there and which is rather successful and might suggest other countries to, let's say, move towards that model.
Right. So that's, a very apt comparison. So let's start with transition, probably, because as you properly pointed out, in the 90s, it was all about a vision of a free market economy with private businesses flourishing and limited government involvement and so on. There was a model of success that, at least in the minds of the architects of the reforms that existed. In a way, you know, I make that brief comment in the book. In a way, this would become just another type of belief, just like the Marxian economics were guiding the policymakers in the Soviet Union. The market economy was guiding in very much with the same much sort of devotion economists of the early 90s. But that's the big question. Transition to what? And I raised this in the book, actually, in the first two chapters of the book, which are a bit more methodological. I talk about, well, transition to begin with, how do we define it? Then transition from what? And then transition to where? Or what is the final destination? And what I discovered in the research working on this is that, again, there was a wide range of publications. People approaching this from a pure neoclassical economics point of view, or trying to build it into more historical perspective and trying to build some kind of framework around that. But there was not much agreement other than, well, the economies have to be more open and liberalized. But what that really meant to the societies was not exactly captured. So I talk about that a little bit. And then in comparing to China, that's where I bring in the definitions and the different aspects of this transition. Because what I would actually propose, and that's captured in the title of the book, is that it's not the transition that happened, but transformation. So if comparing to China, there are several questions that I think we will probably be able to touch on that in more again in a few moments. But specifically, it's the timing, of course. It's the type of the reforms. It's the type of social structure that existed back or characterized the Soviet model and the Eastern European model and what is present in China. It's the methods that are being used in terms of sort of the economic stimulus and so on. And specifically the fact that, and it's been brought up in literature, and there's some new research that is more empirically based, going back into history, and which gives us more foundation, sort of more footing to say that it was the ability in case of China to push the technology and technological innovation into this larger consumer market, which was lacking in the specific case of the Soviet Union transformation. So if we, the difficulty for me is not being a political scientist, I try to avoid making these type of bold statements, but from a macroeconomic perspective, this lacking initiative, so to speak, and just seeing things and taking things as they were and thinking things were fine, and rather than reinvesting into more innovative technology that would bring consumer markets to the forefront, I think that was the one of the problems in the 70s and the 80s in the Soviet Union, which then led to the questions of, well, we have to reform, but how to reform was not really obvious. Again, there was no model of moving from a centralized economy to what was suggested to be a free market economy, because the free market itself was not really clear what that meant. So we have, in the case of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in the 90s, we have the sort of the confluence, that's mix up of political and economic, social and cultural aspects, which I believe are a bit more controlled than if you think about China and this ability to eventually become the global manufacturer, sort of in the case of China.
Thank you very much for answering my question, which was not strictly connected to the book. And now let's go back to the book. So, yes, you start with transition versus transformation. Then you move towards a macroeconomic analysis of this transformation. But then you introduce the notion of human transition. So what have you been measuring and looking at in terms of market and human transformation?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is the aspect that I thought was critical, and that's the one that we often omit in very technical economic analysis that we do. The human transition is, simply put, how is an average person affected by the changing macroeconomic and political environment? There's a tendency to, of course, generalize, and because we work with statistics, and statistics conceal the sort of the direct effects on individuals or even societies. And so the challenge to me was to figure out how to build it into the overall story, the narrative, and at the same time make it in such way that it would still be consistent with this whole discussion of economic change. And I think what I tried to do was that discuss the situation, build towards sort of the understanding of situation of living standards before the 1990s, and then how those started to change after. And there are a couple of ways this could be shown. One was the discussion on the problems of income and wealth inequality. And it's not that we should idealize any previous models or any model whatsoever. But there was a clear objective distinction that in the Soviet compact, so to speak, in this social contract of the time, an average individual had a bit more stability with somewhat government-guaranteed education, minimum education, minimum health care, and in fact, employment. Now, this should not be taken as a perfect world. Obviously, we have to be very objective. There were a lot of, I shouldn't say nuances, but there were quite a lot of problems with this. But at the same time, on average, it provided by 1970s and 1980s, not to speak about the years before, but by early 1980s, that type of a system provided a more of a stability, predictability. And you have a society that is used to that type of environment, and all of a sudden, within a few hours, right, overnight practically, all of that collapses. Now, there's a good side to that, and there's obviously the bad side to that. The bad side is this moment of transition when the societies were taken from one comfort zone and they were transitioning into somewhere else, which was still unknown. And the state guarantees obviously disappeared. The job markets, the labor markets would now resemble the typical capitalist economy labor market with all of its imperfections, but also opportunities, of course. And I think that's important. At the same time, this problem of inequality became even more pronounced. The Soviet Union, of course, was, as pretty much any other society, a hierarchical society. But at the same time, the share of income that would go to 10%, right, income earners, was relatively less than what would happen after. And so what we see in the 90s and then through up to now is that increasing this, the increase and the widening of this gap between the few top earners and the larger share that would be middle or lower middle income groups. So there's that. But another aspect of a human transition was the massive change and massive migration of peoples from pretty much every country. And for that, to appreciate this, one needs to understand the system that was built over the 70 years in the case of Soviet Union, over about 40 years in the case of Eastern Europe. And in the case of Soviet Union, I think it would be more, again, it's much more significant than in the case of Eastern Europe. What was happening, going back all the way in the history, there was continuous change and relocation of peoples, whether voluntarily or forced one way or another. The ethnicities, the religious mix of the regions were changing. And with the breakdown of the centralized support system and the push for national independence, right, sovereignty, and emphasis on one sort of titular nation or one, the key nation as defining, the ethnic conflicts would become more pronounced. In some cases, it led to obviously wars and still ongoing disputes. The sort of that would result in the migration due to war and conflict. But then with the breakdown of economic ties, massive joblessness, massive economic collapse, the other type of migration, the labor migration, would be mostly the economic migration. So that started to change the mix-up of the societies through the 90s, adding more pressure on the relatively well-to-do societies, but still nobody was well-to-do, but in relative terms, better, in economic terms, better, and leads to all sorts of other social pressures within the host and the home countries. So I just pointed out a couple of things, right? The state guarantees the social welfare system, the income inequality, and migration. And I think those three are really important factors to consider, because that is part of this human transition that is still ongoing. People are still trying to get used to, or rather live in the new environment. Everyday situations that result in the larger macro picture, that.
And this human aspect that you have mm-hmm. mentioned is part of the diversity of the model, because of course we can say Eastern Europe and Soviet model, but you have already mentioned that there were so many different nations, and there was a structural diversity and institutional diversity. So the model was applied to countries that were very, very different. And the success of the transition that started earlier or later has been also was so different. So can you tell us, in your book, we find figures and charts about so many different nations. Can you tell us how much was this diversity relevant, important during the Soviet time? And what happened to this diversity when the transition started? And which models, which countries became more successful after the transition?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this emphasis on diversity is really critical in understanding what happened, well, rather what was there before, what happened, and what's happening right now. If we look at all these countries, Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, 29 countries to my count, they came to this same system, the socialist system, in different ways. Those in the Soviet Union were pretty much absorbed by, after the 1917 revolution and the establishment of the Soviet Union later, out of the remnants of what had been the Russian Empire. Those in Eastern Europe and the Baltics would become the byproduct of the world sort of division in the after World War II. And in that there's already a big difference, right? The political aspect of it. There was also a difference in how those countries were industrialized and changed. Now, the Soviets achieved massive progress in education, for example. They were able to achieve maybe that could be counted as a success because basically 100% literacy rate in the early 30s, late 30s or so, close to that, something 90-something percent, and then eventually 100%. At the same time, there was a push for industrialization, right, with the collectivization reforms and industrialization, which I discuss in the book as well. And there's a kind of temptation to see this as, well, this is one great economic development policy, but there's then another side to this, that's the human side to that. And we are reminded that through the 30s, thousands and millions of people had perished due to, you know, there was the environment of great terror and things like that. So that left a mark. And by the time the Eastern European economies come into the fold, the same attempt to industrialize is pushed, but it's done in a slightly different way, in a bit more, should we say, mild way, with less so of, in relative terms, with less insistence on nationalization. For example, in Eastern Europe, which is a case different, very different from what happened in the Soviet Union, but in parts of Eastern Europe, including Poland, much of the agricultural sector would remain still in private hands, would still be private, whereas as we know, in the Soviet Union, the collectivization reforms resulted in effectively all state-owned collective farms. At the same time, the significant investment, in the post-war reconstruction, aimed at strengthening Central European, Eastern European economies, created some sort of a sense of competition among those economies by 1970s and 1980s, and in some way, there's one could argue that it's that backbone created back then that helped them then later to integrate with European Union supply chain much more successfully than, for example, in the case of the Soviet Union economies. The Soviet Union would remain until the last moment a very much centralized economy, right? Sort of the decisions are made in the center and there's a big state plan. And that is how pretty much everything is distributed and was produced with one part. Let's say in any example, even a simple desk, one part being produced in country A and another part in country B, and the whole thing gets assembled in country C and then it's painted in somewhere else. Very simple example, but that was pretty much the plan system that kept everyone involved and provided jobs guarantees. It was not obviously perfect because it clearly, as history shows, it was not sustainable. Whereas in Eastern Europe, things were slightly more different because there was more emphasis with Eastern European economies being able to retain their individuality, especially in national terms, whereas there was not the case in former Soviet Union where it was all one country. There was much more resilience that they would inherit and much more flexibility. Again, all in relative terms, of course, the politics and ideology would still dominate. But in economic terms, those relative differences were important. So maybe a bit of a long preface, but to a short answer, that those initial conditions with which these countries would enter the early 90s and the reforms process, I would think were fundamental in then defining who succeeded in macroeconomic or achieving certain macroeconomic targets and who did not. And they would also, then later in the book, I talk about how they also inform the current situation and how we would understand or try to attempt to understand the current institutional change and current macroeconomic change in that part of the world. So to say that one is successful or the other is not is a bit of a challenge, because success by itself would become a subjective measure. And in macroeconomic terms, I think that would be an explanation that there were the initial differences in the sense of how the industrialization went in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, the results of it, and the ability of Eastern European economies to then integrate on that industrial, leveraging that industrial backbone with the rest of the world.
I would like to ask you something that you don't cover explicitly in the book, which is the industrial-rural divide in the Soviet Union, because this is a problem also in China. It used to be a problem under Mao, and for other reasons, it is still a problem. So how those 29 nations you mentioned dealt with this divide in the same way, in different ways, in more or less successful ways?
Mm-hmm. Well, the socialist model maintained this division, right? You're right. There was a divide between the rural, the agricultural sector and the industrial sector, with strong emphasis on the industrial sector. The difficulty, of course, with then taking this point further was that the industrial sector was just developed for its own sake. It was the production of means of production for the sake of production of more means of production rather than the consumer items. So within the Soviet model, which again would be separate from Eastern European model, the agricultural sector was the dependent sector, right? It was the sector that would provide, it would be the sort of, it's the initial sector that would provide then for successful functioning of the industrial sector. And the industrial sector would be urban, primarily urbanized sector. And back in the days, in the 20s, of course, there was the problem with the differences in prices between the industrial manufactured products and agricultural products, that the purchasing prices for agricultural sector were significantly lower than the manufacturing sector, and that resulted in at the time, peasants not being able to afford any of the consumer items or manufacturing items that were needed in agriculture. So that was resolved in an administrative way. Later on, sort of in the 70s and the 80s, the agricultural sector would still remain largely functioning as based on subsidies, basically, from the state. There were problems with the efficiency, because again, the main focus for the planners was on the industrial capacity and building up the industrial backbone. In a way, one could say that they followed the sort of the development models that we have and we tried, that were tried elsewhere in the world, again, focusing on import substituting industrialization type of approach. However, it was not because of the agricultural productivity that, for example, we had more, there was a need for workers on the factories, but it was simply because the sector existed on the subsidies. So the differences in living standards were also quite visible. Those in the rural areas obviously had limited access, much more limited access to various services, including what I mentioned, the education, healthcare, and so on. The salaries were relatively lower than in the urban areas or industrial areas, and that division would remain. Another problem that existed was the local sort of the system of residency, right, that kept people essentially in the place of their birth, or unless they were appointed after graduating from college to a job, unless they were stationed somewhere, that residency pretty much kept the person to assigned to the place. So the mobility, the internal mobility, unless it was somehow sanctioned, was very much constrained. So again, maintaining that divide between the agricultural and the industrial sectors.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. Can you tell us something about the future, the current situation of Eastern European nations that, by the way, reacted to the latest financial and economic crisis in, again, less or more successful ways, but in particular Russia? So what do you forecast for the future? Completed transition of Russia.
Of course, yeah. So I may give you another long answer, but it goes something like this. The future is always bright. I'm maybe it's part of a character, so but trying to be an optimist, but still, if you just think about everything that we do as researchers, as policymakers, and so on, there's one aim to assure that what comes in the future is something better, something more progressive, kind of simplifies, somehow makes the life better compared to what it is now. So future is always bright. However, that's where the difficulty is. To get to this bright future, we have to accept this past history. And the past is very complicated. I tried to sketch this just now very quickly, but being objective about one's history is probably one of the most difficult things that can be done. And so what that leaves us is with the present. And the present are the policies, the decisions that we make, and sort of the course that we build for the future. So what we're left with in terms of analysis is really looking at that. And what we're seeing happening now in all of these countries is that this layering of different development models, there's a layer that comes from legacy. It is much more stronger in former Soviet Union countries, and Russia obviously is the largest economy, so it's the economy that is mostly visible observers and just on average in the media and so on. And this layering of the influence of legacy is that of a powerful state that provided the basic needs for the society for human development, however good or bad, but there was some type of a guarantee. At the same time, there's another layer, and that's the second layer that comes out of the 1990s and the whole independence movement of the 1990s, which, if we think a bit more, suggests that actually the freedoms enjoyed today by the countries that we're discussing, all of them, Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, those freedoms are very unique to their history. Effectively, what we've got in the 90s is 29 independent nation states. Being part of the Soviet system, in fact, due to migrations and due to the emphasis on national industrial policies and development, in fact, strengthened those countries' self-identification through those decades of being part of the socialist model. So the net result is that they come into the 90s well-prepared to be on their own. And so that leads to the third layer, and that's where there's a realization that to continue as an independent economy, there's a need for a state that takes or a state and the state economic policy that provides some sense of guarantee, some sense of comfort to the society. And at the same time, there's a need for a more progressive, which is viewed as private enterprise. And obviously, there's massive benefit in having private markets and free market. And we will see how that works out. That's the million-dollar question. It really is country going to be dependent on each country's decisions and societies.
Sorry, this now I have a comment on something which is absolutely not related to your book. But recently, a British politician was accused by European leaders, in particular those belonging to former Soviet nations, because he said we need to leave the European Union, which now is acting like the Soviet Union used to act with these satellite nations. And so there is this dream of becoming a more independent nation and abandoning institutions like the European ones that appear, according to them, too oppressive and too involved in planning or regulation of the economies and consumption markets and so on. Any opinions on this, on the role of institutions like the European Union?
I think institutions are very important, right? And I make a point when I talk about transition experience, which I call actually a transformational experience, is that institutions are not mushrooms. They need time. They need time, care, and attention to evolve. And I think I'm not familiar with that comment, although I am familiar with the process that is ongoing, and it's between the UK and the EU. And I think it's, look, there's definitely part of being part of the team, right? And that requires, that imposes certain, sometimes very strong limitations on what can be done or cannot be done within the national policy. And I mean, we see this with the European Unions and the euro, the currency, limited independence and flexibility for each economy in terms of their monetary policy, right? And the same, obviously, with in politics, again, and not exactly my area, but we should, if with any references to the Soviet Union past, one problem what I'm finding is that people either idealize it too much as a great thing, or of some sort of a social haven on Earth, or there's the other extreme of being extremely negative towards it, and this is where I'm hoping that that's where I'm trying to inform the public that actually there's the objective reality is much more complicated, and so just making comparisons with EU being just like the Soviet Union, I'm not really sure that's helpful. The EU does not forcefully collectivized, for example, which was the case of 1920s, right? There are quite significant freedoms within the EU. At the same time, maybe there is something in common, for example, with what I'm familiar in terms of policies towards support of education and healthcare, those type of things. The Soviet Union had the minimum basics and provided for free to each resident education opportunities, the apprenticeship, the model that is in Germany, sort of the apprenticeship model, other services, whatever those might be. So there's a bit of a complicated, rumbled answer. But basically, I think we have to be careful when we start making these type of comparisons. But politicians can get away with many things, I guess.
Thank you very much, Alec. By the way, before I ask you about your next projects, I see that you have already published another book with Routledge, and this was published in 2011. Innovative yes. Fiscal Policy and Economic Development in Transitional Economies. So what is your next project instead?
The next project, I'm interested, despite of everything we just talked about, I'm also interested in the international capital markets, international economy, and how the exchange rates work. So I'm looking at, again, maintaining my regional focus, but looking at how these countries develop in more technical, sort of from a more technical macroeconomic perspective, and specifically through their integration with the global capital markets system. I think it's quite interesting because really there are two globalizers in the world. There's international banking system. If you think about this, the banks pretty much operate the same way everywhere in the world. And the second globalizer is what in the United States they call soccer. In Europe, they call football. more seriously, it's about how this flow of international capital may have any influence on countries' development and access to credit, being able to control or not to control domestic currency values and domestic credit flow may have an influence on development. In the broader sense, that in the past, I've also looked at, and I'm still curious because this topic seems to be coming up. I'm also curious in maybe continuing work on the topic of labor migration. One model that I suggested some time ago was that, especially in the former Soviet Union case, I mentioned this in the remarks earlier, there's a presence of established old communities of different ethnicities which still feel strong affiliation with their historical homelands, wherever those might be. And the migrants, labor migrants coming to the host country from those homelands may have an opportunity to connect with this old diaspora, so to speak. And that could be a more meaningful and less painful way of streamlining migration policy. And I think that's an important factor in Europe right now, and Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union, which relieves the pressure of the societies that are affected. So my interests abroad, but really within the theme of economic development and connecting it with economic history, because I don't think we can be talking seriously about anything without keeping in mind the history that comes with each country case.
Thank you very much, and good luck with your current project. We spoke with Alexander Gevorkian. He is Associate Professor of Economics at St. John's University in the United States. We spoke about his book, just published in 2018 by Routledge. The book is Transition Economies, Transformation, Development, and Society in Eastern Europe and the Former Soviet Union. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.